You are listening to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Joining me now is Paul Bowden, community organizer with the Western Regional Advocacy Project, abbreviated RAP. They're based in San Francisco and were one of the groups campaigning against the passage of the sit-lie ordinance, Proposition L. They also monitor and track examples of policies that criminalize homeless and poor people across the country. Thanks for speaking with us, Paul.
Yes, good afternoon.
So now that San Francisco has passed a ban on sitting and lying on the sidewalk, what should we expect? What have we seen in other cities that have passed similar bans? Assuming it stands up in court, how is this going to change things for the homeless in San Francisco?
Well, assuming it stands up in court the way it's written right now is a pretty big assumption. But I think what we're going to see, regardless of whether it gets watered down in court or not, is just another level of another, they call it a tool for, we call it a level of harassment for the cops to use against the presence of poor people. Homeless people become the identified target in the media around the campaign. In this campaign, they were running commercials all throughout the playoffs, the championship, and the World Series with the Giants. So we're talking serious investment of money and propaganda in order to win these campaigns. But you just add this on top of the list of loitering, you know, sleeping, blocking the sidewalk, panhandling, being in the park after hours, disobeying the signs, trespassing. You just add another level to the list of laws that are being used across the country to remove the presence of poor people from downtown corridors.
And in the early part of the show, we heard about quality of life laws in New York. Now we're talking about San Francisco, but these policies are not limited just to big city metropolises, right?
No, and actually, I mean, in rural communities, you just don't hear about it as much. But in rural communities, they're using these laws just as well. A major piece of the enforcement component for the private security forces are in business corridors and in urban areas. That's just where the property values are higher and business improvement districts are funded through an increase in the property taxes of owners of those properties. And the intensity of the removal of people, of sweeping out Skid Row. You know, just trying to remove poor people from Skid Row is a multi-pronged approach. And we certainly saw that. I grew up in New York City, and it's a very different city today. Manhattan is a very different place today than it was at the time that I was growing up. And those are much more intensive, concentrated efforts. In the rural areas, it's get the hell out of here. The people by them, you know, the homeless people are more isolated. The support network around fighting back is more disparate and more spread out. And when you're struggling with having to take your kid on two different buses going all the way across a major county in Oregon, you know, the ability to organize and fight back against a cop that's being a jerk is much more difficult and much harder to achieve.
What are some other cities you're seeing, particularly policies you object to?
I can't think of a city where we're not seeing it. It's at that point. This is the redevelopment, what the redevelopment agencies did to urban communities in the 60s with the bulldozers is what the business improvement districts and local governments are doing to poor people today and using cops and private security and jails, as opposed to the bulldozers. The gentrification issues are just as intense. The fact that being a nuisance is now considered a crime. And according to the judges in these DOJ report, Department of Justice reports, the judges, the DAs, they refer to these as nuisance crime enforcement programs. So we're not talking about criminal crime enforcement programs. We're talking about one segment of society deeming another segment of our society to be a nuisance. Their presence is a nuisance. And we are basically, you know, going full tilt boogie into we don't need no more residential treatment programs, we don't need outpatient treatment, we don't need affordable housing, you know, we got plenty of money to build more jails, and you know what, these guys will fill them up. And it's an immigrant community, it's young people of color community, it's a homeless community, it's a mentally ill community. It's a very aggressive, very sophisticated, very well thought out, very well funded, very well planned attempt to say, you know, if we can get the dudes to move back from the suburbs into the downtown corridors, and the main thing we need to do in order to achieve that is get rid of the poor people that have been living there when everybody moves out to the freaking suburbs.
And you just mentioned some of the communities. What are the effects of these policies on different types of homeless populations? I know there's an increase in homeless families with the poor economy. With veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, there's a big increase in homeless veterans. And, of course, the mentally ill. How are these quality of life policies affecting these particular and other populations?
Well, and it's funny because here we are in 2010 talking about an increase in these different segments of the homeless community, when in fact we didn't have all of these homeless shelters prior to 1982. The late 1982s, the early 1983s is when we started opening up all of these emergency shelters and we started talking about homelessness as another fabric of our society. Before then it was, you know, the Bowery bums or the detox facilities, and there was battered women facilities, and there was foster care programs, you know, but there wasn't the kind of institutionalized homelessness that we see today and that we've seen since then. And we've done everything but address the root causes of what created that mess. What we have done is we've created a whole level of institutions with the separate courts and the community justice centers and, you know, the quality of life enforcement programs and the business improvement districts. We've created a whole tier of being punitive and penalizing and criminalizing the existence of the people that we want to remove, not address the issue of why so many people are out in our streets, why poverty is rampant, but and why mentally ill people have gone from being institutionalized to deinstitutionalized to reinstitutionalized in our criminal justice system and in our jails, everything but addressing that. And we've created a security apparatus in this country that is just absolutely on steroids and is off the hook. It's the fastest growing business in America today is the security, private security business. And if we really think that that's what is going to, that that's going to be effective in addressing the poverty, we're sadly mistaken. And we know we're sadly mistaken. And the level of crap that poor people are willing to tolerate and put up with is what we're trying to address through our organizing, through our artwork, through our public education, and through our training. And communities across the West Coast and throughout the country are really coming together and saying, you know, this isn't a homeless issue. This isn't an immigrant rights issue. This isn't a disability rights issue. This isn't a housing issue. This isn't a gentrification. This is a social justice issue. This is about building a social justice movement that says an injury to one really is an injury to all. And if we allow them to just pick off different segments in the SB 1070 stuff in Arizona, that now it comes out in the mainstream media was actually written and pushed and financed by the people that are going to build the jails that these guys are going to end up living in. That's about all of us. That's not just that's about a social policy that says the way that we address poverty in the United States of America today is we build jails and we lock people up. And we scare the hell out of them to behave the way we want them to behave. Because if we don't have to see them, if we don't have to hear them, and then it doesn't exist. There is no homelessness in America if Disney company isn't having to see homeless people in Times Square. I mean, sadly ironic article was in the New York Times about how there's one homeless person left in Times Square in Manhattan. And it's okay because he's a good homeless person and we know him and it's all right. And I couldn't believe that they actually expected people to swallow that this was done through police outreach and housing first. That's not what addressed it. What addressed it was the police and the private security guards in Times Square making it so untenable for poor people to exist there without constant harassment, without constant fear of being beaten up, without being pushed down the road or without being arrested, being picked up in paddy wagons and taken to the Bronx. And having the cops say, this is where you belong. That's what is removed the presence of poor people from Times Square. And that's what they're trying, and they're trying to use that, the New Cities America dudes and the International Downtown Association that go around the country doing amicus briefs every time these things are challenged in court, and then helping in Oregon, in Portland, Oregon, they redesigned their sit-lie law three separate times after it was thrown out in court. And it was always the Business Improvement District dudes that came back, worked with the city in order to recraft the law so it would have a better chance of surviving in court. Not so that it would address the issue of why so many people are out in the streets panhandling, but so that we could criminalize those people and have it done in a way that would stand up in the court system. And knowing that poverty is not a protected class, homelessness is not a protected class. And so long as you equally attack everybody who's poor and homeless, you can come up with legal arguments to justify the existence of those laws.
And like you said, some people are actually pleased with these policies. And so I want to ask, you know, how do we reach some sort of consensus in terms of moving forward? Because it seems like cities around the country and even other parts of the world are using these policies. They believe it will lead to a drop in crime, and their statistics and anecdotal evidence maybe show the policies work. But then from your perspective in human rights and social justice advocates, they say, well, they're not working. So is there a truth, or is it more about what kind of city people want to live in? If people want to live in a city that appears to be visually clean and they don't want anyone asking for change, are these policies defensible? Are these really the right way to go if that's your only goal?
Well, I mean, you could say Hoovervilles worked, but they didn't work for very long. Anti-Okie laws worked, but they didn't work for very long. Jim Crow laws worked, but they didn't work for very long. Sunset laws and sundown laws worked, but they didn't work for very long. This stuff ain't going to work for very long either. And in the scope of since we stole this country, how long we've been here, you know, this last 15 years ain't all that long a time. And if you're talking a social experiment of saying, well, you know what, we don't want to fund education, we don't want to fund treatment, we don't want living wages for our workers, we'd rather ship our jobs overseas or wherever the labor's cheaper, you know, we don't want any of that stuff. So we're just going to focus on policing a comfortable environment for people to shop in. And that's going to be the priority for our social policy in the United States of America. You can maybe get away with it for a little while, you know? You can, for a little while, get away with oppression. There's only so far you can beat people down before they turn around and bite you in the butt. And the fact that we are turning around and getting ready to bite them in the butt is a good sign for where we're at. And the fact that we're not going to disappear and cease to exist. I mean, I know that there's a segment of the society that really wishes homeless people were more like lemmings, and that once you lost your housing, you'd march off into the freaking sea. And that's just not going to happen. And the first tool for the organizers that actually believe in social justice, you know, is reinstating a sense of entitlement. I mean, why is it seen as bad that people in this country feel a sense of entitlement in terms of what we expect of our government? That we expect a decent education for all people, that we expect access to health care for all people. That I know is seen as, oh God, how dare they? But every rich dude I've ever run across has a sense of entitlement of what they expect from the politicians that they buy and fund the campaigns for. And it's not seen as outrageous when millionaires have a sense of entitlement of expecting clean, decent streets, of expecting a safe neighborhood to live in. But when poor people have those same expectations, even having a place to live, much less clean, decent streets and a safe community to live in, just having a place is seen as, well, how dare you? Where do you come off with that sense of entitlement? Well, you know, I think poor people in this country need to really get down and say, you know what, it's okay for me to expect from my government. You know, and the first part, I guess, of that would be believing and acknowledging that it is our government, because I don't think that that's readily apparent at this point. And I don't think that the cops right now, when they say to serve and protect, you know, they really need to put some after that saying.
You mentioned that it's a multi-pronged approach. these anti-poor people policies. And there's two aspects you brought up. I'm wondering if you could expand on a little bit. One is you mentioned there's kind of a parallel set of courts that's been created, and the other is the private security forces. Could you talk a little bit more about each of those?
The separate courts were basically created because the court system, I always hesitate when I start to slip and call it the criminal justice system, but the court system was just completely being overwhelmed and inundated with social issues, not with criminal issues. And seeing more and more people coming up before the court because they had an addiction, they had a mental illness, they were homeless, or all of those things. And in the classic neoliberal way in which segments of our charity nonprofit institutions operate, rather than address, well, okay, so maybe we need to stop criminalizing all of these people so that they're not ending up in the court system. And this is where the San Francisco Chronicle has written article after article after article attacking the Homeless Coalition for providing legal representation to homeless people that are being criminalized for being homeless. That's not cool. Legal representation, that's not cool. No, no, no. We'll set up separate courts for those people. And so now we have substance abuse courts, we have mental health courts, we have homeless courts, we have community justice centers, and I'm sure within a couple of years of federal funding and think tank analysis and liberal meetings and conferences around the country and research upon research upon research, they'll come up with some other courts, I'm sure of it. And the whole premise is you have to plead guilty. You know? So the idea of the presumption of innocence and the right to an attorney and the right to an adequate defense is thrown out the window. If you're in one of these courts, of course you're guilty. And maybe we'll try to hook you up with a program. Now, what we have seen in the substance abuse arena is those program slots, 9 times out of 10, come out of the general pool of access to those programs. So you go to a social worker trying to get into a treatment program, it's very likely that you're not going to find any, it's not very likely, it's absolutely true that you're going to be placed on a waiting list for months and months and months and months. You know, you're mentally ill and you're trying to get into a treatment program, good luck. Good luck. It's going to take you many, many, many attempts, and then just really good luck hitting it on the right day at the right time, you know. But somehow this idea that, well, we'll just send them through the criminal justice system and we'll send them through the court system and that way they'll get access is absolutely reactionary to the situation in a way that doesn't address any of those issues. And in the mental health arena, we've seen where people are actually spending longer in local jail waiting for access to a treatment slot than they would have if they had just been serving the time and being released. So, of course, if you're going to keep eliminating access to treatment services, you're going to keep people in jail longer, even with an alternative sentencing mindset. But it's making a lot of money for a lot of folks, and the Consensus Project's getting big money to do studies about it, and they love to have these little friendly neoliberal-esque meetings and conferences where they can talk about best practices of how the police are going out with social workers to harass and remove from sight the presence of homeless people. You know, somehow, I mean, just your presence is illegal. And, you know, it's the new trend right now. It's the new buzz. It's the foundations love it. And to us, it's incredibly condescending. And and you don't see, like, we just did outreach to 250 self-identified mentally ill homeless people. And in all the literature, which could fill a giant office with the reports that have been written about the incarceration rates of mentally ill people going sky high, no one, from the literature reviews that academics have done for us on the work we're doing, we can't find another instance where anybody just actually went out and talked to them directly. You know, they love to study us, but to actually ask what we think, what our experiences are, You know, and 76% of the people that we talked to have been arrested or cited under quality of life enforcement type programs. And that's in six cities, and that's just a random sampling of talking to 255 people. You know, that tells you that this is a severe and intensive criminalization campaign. And, you know, it's the flavor of the month right now, but it's really sad statement that in 2010, America's answer to homelessness and poverty is to get private security and cops to make it disappear.
One of the things your group does is it tries to assist the homeless in organizing themselves and advocating for themselves. Can you talk a bit about how that works and why that's important?
Yeah, well, the Western Regional Advocacy Project spun out of years and years of frustration between, I had worked, I was homeless here in San Francisco and then had worked at the Homeless Coalition for 16 years. And, you know, the organizations that pulled RAP together are all West Coast organizations that have been around for on average 20 years. I think our youngest one is like 15 years old. And there was an incredible disconnect and mayor's races and city supervisors or county supervisor races, homelessness was the number one issue. But when you looked at the governor's races, the presidential campaigns, and I'm going back to 87, 88, 89, you know, it never came up. It wasn't a freaking issue. And when it did come up at all, for the most part on the local level, it was about closing a park or people urinating and defecating in the alleys or in the doorways or in the streets. It wasn't about refunding affordable housing. It wasn't about refunding residential mental health treatment. It wasn't about living wages. It was about the consequences of the fact that homelessness existed as opposed to the solutions to actual homelessness. And the feds every once in a while would have local communities write these 5-year plans or these 10-year plans, and they would have us compete with each other for funding for off the crumbs on the table. And the nonprofit community and the homeless people started getting further and further apart from each other. And if you, God forbid, stood up to any mayor's campaign, Newsom just being the most recent in a long line of them, but if you disagreed with that, if you fought back against it, and you were getting funded by the city, you weren't going to be getting funded for very long. And the ability for the shelter, when I was coming up off the street and I was coming up through this place, Hospitality House in the Tenderloin, you know, if I had some 70-year-old guy show up at the shelter I was volunteering at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I had some 22-year-old like I was at the time, you know, I could just say, hey, dude, can this old man have your bed? Oh, yeah, no problem. You know, like the ability to be humane and respond to what was going on. And the check-in time was 11 o'clock at night. Now it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That's a jail. That's not a shelter. But the providers no longer run the show. They don't design a program based on what the community says we need and want and is the most effective. They implement what the mayor's office comes up with in some freaking stupid little chronic homeless initiative or 10-year plan or 5-year plan. I mean, the idea that a community responds to the people in its community in a way that is humane and is responsive to what's happening would have gotten us the federal funding back for affordable housing a long time ago. And instead, we're further away from it than we've ever been. HUD right now is talking about privatizing all the public housing stock by mortgaging it off. So we're actually going in the other direction, in the wrong direction, which is bringing in a bunch of public housing resident groups and homeless groups working together to fight this stuff. You know, so the more they attack us, the more we come together as different communities of people that are all fighting for social justice. And so RAP was created to get to that point, to put out a message that connects the cuts to affordable housing and the advent of contemporary homelessness in the early 80s, to push for a WPA type of program, to stop the criminalization of our communities. And so we, RAP, doesn't actually do the organizing with homeless people. That's not the role that we've been asked to play. The local organizations that make up RAP do that social justice organizing work at the local level. We create the tools and the artwork and the reports and the research and the strategizing and coordinate the campaign so that all of our cities are working together on one campaign fighting for social justice. Originally, this was a proposal that was put forward to the National Coalition for the Homeless by groups in Chicago, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, New York, San Francisco, as a way that we saw of structuring a national organizing project. And that's not rocket science. The unions do it, other, you know, local chapters, regional chapters. When that wasn't they decided not to go that route and how they wanted to structure themselves, and that's absolutely their right to, I'm not complaining. But those of us on the West Coast decided, well, we're going to do it anyway. We think it's a good structure. We think it's how you build an organizing base and build a movement, is to have local organizations that are connected to their communities and accountable to their communities drive what the priorities are going to be and what that organizing is going to center on. And so we just went ahead and started doing it and hoping and knowing that it'll spread.
Are there any cities or towns that are doing a good job, in your opinion, in aiding the homeless population, developing real solutions? Are there any specific examples of places that are bucking the trend of moving towards criminalization and taking another path?
I have not yet been able to identify a local community that is bucking the trend of criminalization. Hope to God there's some out there. One, as we saw with Santa Monica, when I believe it was Charlie Sheen or somebody was the mayor of whatever, when they announced that they were going to be a sanctuary for homeless people, they paid quite a price for it. And so it's very possible that, you know, like I know El Paso really stood up to this whole 10-year plan stuff, and to the point that they actually wrote HUD and said, we're not doing this garbage, the chronic homeless stuff, because chronic homeless was all about single individuals, and they were like, we're fighting for families. So, you know, keep your chronic homeless initiative and go away. And so there are communities that are standing up on some of the policy stuff and but in terms of bucking the business improvement districts and the criminalization, you know, I keep my fingers crossed. I just haven't yet been invited to hang out in any of those towns.
Paul Bowden is an organizer with the Western Regional Advocacy Project. Their website is wraphome.org, and we'll link to it on our website, radioproject.org. Thanks so much for joining us, Paul.
Yeah, thank you very much.